Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Breaking news, judge sends Paul Manafort to jail pending trial. 2 weeks after Robert Mueller's prosecutors dropped new accusations of witness tampering on him, U.S. District Judge Amy Berman Jackson revoked Manafort's bail earlier today. He's now in jail. The judge emphasized to Manafort how she could not make enough rulings to keep him from speaking improperly with witnesses after he had used multiple text messaging apps and called a potential witness on an Italian cell phone. Quote, "This is not middle school. I can't take his cell phone," she said of Manafort. "I thought about this long and hard. Mr. Manafort, I have no appetite for this." Manafort also entered a not guilty plea to two additional charges levied against him last week for witness tampering and conspiracy to obstruct justice. In total, Manafort faces 7 criminal charges in D.C. federal court. In response to this, Trump complains that Manafort's jailing on witness tampering allegations is, quote, "very unfair," end quote. President Trump said today that the jailing of his former campaign manager, Manafort, was a tough sentence, charging that Judge Amy Berman Jackson's decision to respond to allegations of witness tampering was very unfair. Wow, what a tough sentence for Paul Manafort, who has represented Ronald Reagan, Bob Dole, and many other top political people and campaigns, according to Trump on Twitter. Didn't know Manafort was the head of the mob. He might not be the head of the mob, but Trump conspicuously omitted the fact that Manafort not only advised Reagan and Bob Dole, but he also advised dictators such as Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos, the former Democratic Republic of Congo leader Mobutu Sese Seko, and Angolan guerrilla leader Joseph Zavimbi. Don't forget, Trump ran on the idea of deconstructing the administrative state, along with attacking the media, attacking the judiciary, one of the 3 co-equal branches of government, plays right into that mentality. This is a very dangerous guy. Now, in what I see as a related story, Trump lawyer Michael Cohen might cooperate with federal prosecutors. Michael Cohen, President Trump's longtime attorney and personal fixer, will soon be parting from the lawyers who are representing him. The dispute between Cohen and his lawyers involves the payment of his legal bills, part of which are being financed by who? The Trump family. Cohen has also had more longstanding concerns about the lawyers. As his case moves forward, possibly toward criminal charges, he's been thinking for some time about hiring a new legal team with stronger relationships with federal prosecutors. Now, many see this as Cohen trying to send a not-so-subtle message to Trump about a pardon. Is Cohen trying to let the president know, "I'm not feeling much love and respect from you lately, and you might want to intervene here for me, or else I may have to start singing like a canary"? Is the president becoming more like the frog in the warming water? It seems to be heating up, but Trump is just swimming confident. So, the IG Michael Horowitz, Inspector General for the Department of Justice, released his much-anticipated 500-page report, the most comprehensive look back at the investigation into Hillary Clinton's use of an unclassified private email server. So we've all been waiting for this report from the Department of Justice with bated breath. It's 500 pages. It criticized Director Comey for breaking with longstanding policy and publicity, discussing in a news conference and a pair of letters in the middle of the campaign an investigation into Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server in handling classified information. The report is especially critical of two FBI officials, Peter Strost and Lisa Page, who exchanged text messages disparaging Trump. Many of those text messages had already been released, but the report cites a previously undisclosed exchange. And here's the exchange. Mr. Trump is not ever going to be president, right? Right, according to Ms. Page. No, Mr. Stroke wrote. No, he won't. We'll stop it. Now, what are we to make of this report? Trump says the report exonerates him, then says Horowitz blew it at the very end. The Inspector General, Michael Horowitz, did not challenge the conclusion that Mrs. Clinton should not be prosecuted. That investigation loomed over most of the presidential campaign, and Horowitz and his investigators uncovered no proof that political opinions at the FBI influenced its outcome. Quote, "We found no evidence that the conclusions by department prosecutors were affected by bias or other improper considerations," he wrote. "Rather, we concluded that they were based on the prosecutor's assessment of facts, the law, and past department practice." There still seems to be a lot missing here. The Justice Department Inspector General's report reinforces several crucial points and opens the door to new questions. Most vividly, in case anyone might have thought otherwise, Horowitz makes clear that Comey was far from impeachable. He does not, in the report, come out to be the model Boy Scout that many had claimed he was. The report says he was insubordinate, went outside the department's chain of command, and broke with FBI norms. So the really question to me then is, how can Comey remain disconnected from the bias of his underlings? And it appears to me that there's a lot more to this that the DOJ has either failed to address or is not just going through all of the proper documents as well as providing the necessary documents to the congressional oversight committees. I think there's more damning information to come than folks want to admit. Defense contractors cashing in on immigrant kids' detention. Separating refugee and immigrant children from their parents isn't just an emotionally wrenching policy. It's an enterprise that is benefiting intelligence and defense contractors. Those contractors, including one with a history of scandals, have advertised a flurry of jobs in recent weeks to support the infrastructure surrounding undocumented children whom the Trump administration has taken from their families. One of them, from Virginia-based MVM Inc., seeks a compliance coordinator to help in San Antonio, Texas, with the rapid deployment of an emergency influx shelter for unaccompanied children. As billed, the coordinator would serve the children's shelter met policies and procedures set by the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Refugee Resettlement. MVM posted the job on its website this week. MVM appears to believe its business is growing. A job posting on Indeed.com from 20 days ago advertises for youth care workers in anticipation of contract award. Is this part of a developing pattern? Outsourcing this type of work to the private sector has become the policy choice of the day. For example, on the education side, a senior U.S. Department of Education official hired straight out of the for-profit college sector helped dismantle regulations designed to protect students defrauded by for-profit colleges into taking out five-figure loans on promises they would get better jobs. This is a move that could benefit the former employers of the Education Department advisor Robert Eitel, hired by the Trump administration last February after 4 years in the for-profit college industry. So there are about 20,000 former students from Corinthian College that have sued the school. Corinthian College was shut down in 2015, weeks after the Obama Education Department slapped the business with a $30 million fine for inflating students' job placement rates. Betsy DeVos, head of the Department of Education, she has proposals for changing student loan forgiveness programs and has come under attack for this. critics noting that she has held investments in student loan collection agencies and hired the CEO of a private student loan company to head the Office of Federal Student Aid. DeVos is allowing private sector interests and profits to control what should be a protection of the public interest. And we're seeing this very similar outsourcing idea with the Virginia-based MVM as they are providing emergency shelter for immigrant children. Where is congressional oversight on all of this? You're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more, much more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Last week, Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain committed suicide. As we discussed last week, according to the Centers for Disease Control, suicide rates rose sharply across the United States. Suicide rates in all but one state between 1999 and 2016, with increases seen across age, gender, race, and ethnicity, according to the report. In more than half of all deaths in 27 states, the people had no known mental health condition when they ended their lives. What does this mean? And again, I know we discussed this last week, but I got the opportunity to bring on my first guest, and I just could not pass this up. She is an American psychiatrist with Yale University and a specialist in violence prevention programs in prisons and in the community who initiated reforms at New York's Rikers Island Prison. In 2017, she organized a conference on the mental health of President Donald Trump at Yale and was the editor of The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, a book of essays that has contributed to the debate about Trump's mental stability and within the psychiatric profession about the interpretation of the Goldwater Rule. She is becoming my favorite psychiatrist, Dr. Bandy Lee. Greetings and thanks for coming on The Critical Hour. America is heralded as the land of the free and the home of the brave, the land of milk and honey. With all of this wealth, all of this prosperity and opportunity, why are so many people taking their lives?
First of all, let me say I speak for myself and not for Yale University. Mm-hmm. Thank you again for having me. In terms of suicides, homicides, and other violent deaths, they're far more correlated with social, cultural, and economic matters than with personal reasons. And so when we see epidemics of violent deaths, we can figure out the causes from a societal level, and economics and culture, social issues come into play. So what we're seeing in terms of the rise in suicide rates, the rise in violent deaths in general, is something that we could have expected based on the rise in inequality, economic inequality. Now, you might wonder, what does suicide have to do with economic conditions, especially inequality, which is a more social, a society-wide analysis? But as complex as violence is, in terms of having personal factors, family, community, and societal factors, there is one aspect that almost precisely predicts whether or not homicides and suicides will go down or whether they will go up. And that is economic inequality. This has been studied throughout the world in many different countries over extended periods of time. And it has been shown that if we put suicide and homicide together, in other words, count the total violent deaths, it follows almost exactly the rise and fall of inequality. And what we've seen in this country is a rapid rise in inequality measures throughout the last 30 years, and that's what we're seeing in terms of violent death rates.
So if I understand what you're saying, we can't simply look at suicide by itself. We have to look at violent death in total, because based upon economic inequality, violence manifests itself different ways. Some of it is internalized, as in suicide, and some of it manifests itself externally in terms of aggression towards others. So right now, for example, there are a number of police officials and other experts that are looking at the homicide rate that is dropped. But as the Center for Disease Control report shows, homicide external violence is dropping. Internal violence is on the rise.
Exactly. We can understand the trends a lot better if we put them together. And that's what I discovered in a number of studies that I've done in terms of looking at the course of violent deaths and over the course of our nation's history. For the last 110 years, I've studied suicide and homicide rates put together, and that is much more clarifying in terms of illuminating the trends. Often we think about homicides as being separate from suicides, as being separate from collective violence and massacres and warfare, but actually putting them together gives us a much clearer sense of what is happening. And that's one of the reasons why the World Health Organization, since they put out a landmark document, the World Report on Violence and Health, that was in 2002. And that actually opened up the avenue for looking at violence as a health problem rather than just a criminal justice problem or a security problem. And what we found is that if we put suicides, interpersonal violence, and collective violence all together, then we can understand the whole phenomenon of violence a lot better, which is actually very predictable and preventable.
One of the data points in the study that jumped out at me was the what I'll call slightly less than middle-aged cohort, the 30 to 37-year-old white male cohort, whose suicide rate has gone up exponentially. And that just really struck me as odd. In America, with white male privilege still being prevalent in the American culture, why are so many younger white males deciding to end their lives by their own hand?
Again, it's economic inequality that matters, not just absolute poverty. And we have unprecedented absolute wealth in our country, and yet people are feeling much more stressed and have poor health and violent tendencies than you would expect given the level of wealth. And that all has to do with inequality. In fact, many studies have been done on happiness and indices of happiness. And it turns out that even very poor countries, if they have low levels of inequality, then people are much happier than in rich countries that have a great deal of inequality. So what we're seeing right now is the widening gap between the rich and the poor. And one group has been feeling it especially acutely lately, but it's not the only group. Different groups have felt it at different times.
Mm-hmm.
Remember a couple decades ago when the homicide rate, especially among African-American males, was highlighted. Well, they were feeling the economic inequality sooner than the white males, and that's why they may be a distance apart in terms of the waves and also in terms of manifestation, because cultural factors play a role. Certain groups may be more outwardly violence prone, as you were describing. It can be more outward or it can be inward, depending on the culture. And we have a culture where, as you were saying, you know, white male privilege, in absolute terms, it is far more privileged than the other groups. But in relative terms, relative to what they have been experiencing, what it has been, it's a precipitous drop. And therefore, what they're feeling is much more of the effects that would generate violent behavior and including self-directed violence.
So are we seeing, for example, more white male college graduates who get out of school. Up to that point, they had believed and been convinced that there was something out there for them, a job incredibly profitable, a career incredibly profitable. They've now come into this realistic economy, and they're struggling like everyone else. And because they're not meeting the prescribed societal expectations, they deem themselves as failure, and they don't see a future for themselves, and so they use suicide as a way out. Is that simplistic, I think, but still somewhat accurate?
Yes, those are some of the dynamics you would expect, and I believe that we are observing in the population when we do individual interviews, for example. Those are the kinds of stories that will have influenced some of the decision-making if anyone were to engage in self-harm or be thinking about suicide. So there are, in terms of thinking about violence, we think in ecological terms. So there are individual factors, relationship factors, family, and community elements. But what is often underplayed are the societal elements, the societal factors, far more heavily, even in individual behavior. That was one of the things that was first observed when large-scale studies were done by Emil Durkheim, the
sociologist,
showed that even suicide, the most private act of suicide, is sociologically determined. In other words, the culture plays a huge role in terms of whether or not one decides to go that route. And there are many factors at play. As you said, there can be the more immediate personal effects one is feeling. But when you divide a society into the rich and the poor, the powerful and the weak, the superior and the inferior, then the stress and the burden becomes much greater not to fall into the inferior group. But of course, you know, the inferior group is going to be much greater. If we think about the 1% versus the 99%, then those who are succeeding will be exceedingly small in number, and those who are failing will be that much larger, and the stakes will be higher in terms of self-image, the symbolism, the social standing, and so forth. And that drives many more individuals toward violence. And that does not mean that the upper 1% fares better either. In fact, studies show that in unequal societies, in fact, we're doing worse all across the board. We do worse in terms of health, in terms of life expectancy, in terms of violent tendencies. And so those on the upper echelons may not direct their violence outward, but because they have that much responsibility, and perhaps those who are more conscious of what is happening would feel more guilt, those are the kinds of things that would direct the violence inward. So violence is actually, I often term it a societal disorder.
Mm-hmm. Before we move to my Donald Trump question, there was one other thing in your studies I found incredibly, incredibly interesting. You see a direct statistically relevant correlation between the political party in power and the rate of suicide.
That's right. You're citing my 2014 study where we did extensive statistical analyses, and we gave it incredible rigor and tested multiple times in all different directions to make sure that we were not biased in any way. And political party was just one of the factors we were considering. We were looking at unemployment rates. We were looking at economic prosperity of the country in general, growth rates. And what the study showed was that in the past 110 years, almost without exception.
I think there were two, weren't there?
highly significant, even if we counted the exceptions. And yes, the exceptions were Theodore Roosevelt and Jimmy Carter. And what the trends that we found were that even if we excluded policy, even if we discounted unemployment rates and all of that, that the party of the presidency alone could predict the rise or fall of violent death rates.
So much so that you were even able to predict, or you said that when the Republicans won the presidency in 2016, you predicted the increase in suicide.
Yes. So that is actually what we're seeing in terms of, if I can go back to the economic inequality part, economic inequality has been rising for 40 years. And over the course of 40 years, you'll see a spike in homicides, and then it's been going down precipitously and then stayed stagnant. But if we look at suicide rates, it has only recently gone up in the last couple decades. But if we combine them together, what we see is a consistent rise alongside inequality. Now, these things have been mitigated during Democratic presidencies. And so what we have found is that for every presidential cycle, if we have a Republican president in office, the homicide and suicide rates on average double. And when we have a Democratic president in office, it on average halves. Now, this is not a causal relationship. It's, we don't know which way the causal relationship goes. Even is a, there may be a third factor that's causing both. But based on that consistency for 110 years, without exception, other than those two presidents I mentioned, which if you think about their general policy and orientation, Theodore Roosevelt was accused of being more Democrat than a Republican. Jimmy Carter was kind of unable to be of much effect because of the Republicans around him. And even it may even turn out to be the same for Barack Obama. We don't have the
data yet. As I stated in the opening, in 2017, you organized a conference on the mental health of President Donald Trump at Yale, and you were the editor of The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, a book of essays that has contributed to the debate about Trump's mental stability. With recent events, such as his initial statements about war with North Korea, his outbursts in Canada directed at Prime Minister Trudeau, and more sordid details about extramarital affairs, et cetera, have your observations from 2016 and 2015, have your observations been confirmed, remained the same, or has your level of concern become heightened as it relates to President Trump and his mental stability?
Well, the level of my concern has heightened because now we're seeing all that we had predicted a year and a half ago now play out in the political and geopolitical sphere. And it is very frightening. Now, what the primary and most urgent concern that we raised awareness about was his mental instability and being in a position where he has access to the nuclear codes without any interference. And while that may be the primary and most immediate danger, there are many other dangers that one could argue are even more pernicious because they're not as easily visible and because they will be pervasive and affect us for many years, if not decades, to come. And that is the way in which he lays the groundwork for a culture of violence, which could give rise to epidemics of violence. And we're already seeing the immediate effects. We do have the statistics in terms of the unprecedented spike in hate crimes.
Yes.
That started the day after his election and have gone unabated. There has been a doubling of white supremacist killings in his first year of office. There's been widespread schoolyard bullying that has been done in his name, directly attributable to him.
In fact, it's not only schoolyard bullying. I am hearing what I would you as a psychiatrist would figure anecdotal, but still a lot of workplace bullying and violence, even within offices in the United States government, is on the rise.
Right. It's not, and it's it's quite pervasive. That's why a change in culture is that profound. And in the geopolitical sphere, brutal dictators have been emboldened.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of rhetoric is on the rise all around the world. So what that translates into in terms of spreading brutality, violence, and increased number of deaths, we'll only figure out later. And those are the really frightening rises in danger, because the most lethal violence is actually hidden. We spoke about economic inequality. Well, in violence studies, we also call it a form of violence, because it's a form of violence in terms of causing excess death that would not have happened if one group of people were not subjugating another. And that number of excess deaths far outnumber all the suicides, homicides, terrorism, genocides, warfare, civil wars, all of those combined. It's about more than tenfold in number. So it's the deadliest form of violence.
Mm. Dr. Bandy Lee, thank you so much for your time. American psychiatrist with Yale University and a specialist in violence prevention programs. Thank you. Thank you so much for your time. Again, you are becoming my favorite psychiatrist. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Have a good weekend.
You too.
You are listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. It's Friday, and it's time for us to discuss the issues covered this week and to delve into others. And we turn to my live line, and he's an author, speaker, and public interest advocate. He hosts the Whistleblower Summit for Civil and Human Rights. He is Michael McRae, Esquire, and CPA. Michael McRae, greetings and welcome to the Critical Hour.
Thank you, Dr. Leon. I'm shooting for your favorite whistleblower.
Oh, you got that. You got that. I'm sorry. That award came out last week. I thought you had gotten the information. You are my favorite whistleblower.
All right, my man.
let's do this quickly. Explain to the audience the Whistleblower Summit and why, particularly now as we're looking at, we're going to get into talking about the DOJ report. We're going to be talking about briefly about Paul Manafort and so on and so forth. I know they're not whistleblowers, but talk about the Whistleblower Summit and why that's so significant.
Sure. Well, Dr. Leon, in a nutshell, I grew up in Arkansas and blew the whistle. I was able to go to Washington, D.C. during the Clinton administration and worked on the Federal Empowerment Zone program. Long and short of it is, I blew the whistle on $40 million worth of waste, fraud, and abuse, and it changed my life forever. One of the things that happened to me is I had the full whistleblower journey from retaliation, lost my home, lost my fiance. I almost lost my mind. And one of the things that helped me was I happened to go to, then it was called the Washington Whistleblowers Week. In 2007, there was a meeting of whistleblowers and advocates on Capitol Hill. And because this was one of the most significant conferences or gatherings in my life, because I was able to connect with other people who had experienced the same thing I had, and so it formed a form of community. And so one of the things that I do, so again, I'm a whistleblower and an advocate, and one of the things that I do to give back is I host the Whistleblower Summit for Civil and Human Rights. And so it's built on that model. We've been doing it as the summit for about 6 or 7 years now. And every year we meet on Capitol Hill on July 30th. And it's anchored on July 30th. And the reason that is that's National Whistleblower Appreciation Day. That's that the very first whistleblower law was passed by the Continental Congress in 1778. And so during this conference, we have workshops, we have discussion groups, and we even have luncheons, dinners. We do venues are on Capitol Hill and off Capitol Hill at the National Press Club. And then we also do something for the community that's more of a book signing and a movie night. And the reason that is that while a lot of times we talk about whistleblowing in terms of policy and legal activism, but it's really a pop culture phenomenon, is that a lot of times our favorite books and movies are whistleblower tales. And so what this does, it allows us to be, sometimes we're esoteric and then sometimes we're popular. And so this year we're planning on screening having a premiere screening of a whistleblower documentary at the summit. So we want everybody to come out, everybody to participate, everybody to listen and follow the blog. The website is www.whistleblowersummit.com, www.whistleblowersummit.com, and we hope everybody can participate.
In listening to your story and knowing a little bit about your background, I find it incredibly shocking, and excuse me for being naive, but we grew up taking civics and we grew up understanding history, and we were always taught about honesty and the Constitution and what government is there to do. It's there to serve the people. And when those in government stray from what they were sent there to do, which was take care of the public interest, they're supposed to be held accountable. But our history is just continuously replete with examples of people such as yourself who see the fraud, waste, and abuse that's going on around them. They bring it to attention through the proper channels, and then you wind up suffering. And the hypocrisy is just nauseating. What is it? Is there, can you, and this may be one of the dumbest questions ever asked, but can you put your finger on why it is that it's so hard for people such as yourself when they are trying to expose problems like this, you wind up being the victim?
Well, Dr. Leon, of course, I've given this a lot of thought, right?
So the question's not as dumb as I think it is.
Yeah, no, it's not, because what happens is your premise is kind of the golden rule of salute the flag and America the beautiful. And
well, and we hear Donald Trump talked about waste. How are you going to manage the budget? Waste, fraud, and abuse. We're going to eliminate waste, fraud, and abuse. You looked at the Obama elections and, every, you know, all those candidates, waste, fraud, and abuse. The first thing we're going to do is we're going to deal with waste, fraud, and abuse. And then people like Michael McCray wind up losing their homes, losing their jobs, and damn near losing their minds.
Absolutely correct. Well, the thing is, one is you can't deal with waste, fraud, and abuse in the federal government without protecting whistleblowers. I mean, it's impossible. We're the ones who have the information. But it's also, it was interesting to me, Dr. Leon, because some of the advice that my friends who were sociologists were much more helpful than from my friends who were lawyers.
Okay.
When you start off with this paradigm that, you know, we live in a nation of laws and the law is the law, well, I mean, that's very good and it's wonderful for the study of law. But when you get into the practice of law, these administrative agencies and the courts and whatnot, it's much more an exercise of sociology. It's about power and economics. The law really comes in when you have tied. It's a tie in terms of power.
I always would tell my students in policy classes, there's a huge difference between the theoretical and the practical. And when you're trying to implement policy, what sounds good and what on the surface appears to make a whole lot of sense may not make as much sense as you think when you actually try to make it work.
There you go. As applied.
As applied.
So that's what, I mean, that's what it really comes down to. So a lot of times, you know, people think that whistleblowers are naive, and I guess to a certain extent we are. But they are the people who believe in the system. They are the people who believe in the rule of law. They are the people who believe in the courts. Because simply put, if they didn't, they would not undertake this journey.
Mm. Well, there you go. You know, I have people say to me all the time, Wilmer, how can you speak out the way you speak out, Wilmer? And hey, there's a constitution in play. I got a First Amendment. I'm not doing anything illegal, and I'm protected by the laws of the land. And then we find out, well, as they say in animal farm, all animals are equal, just some on the farm are more equal than others.
There you go. And I tell you, it's frightening now, in the sense that we have the executive who I really question, has he ever taken the civics class? How do you have your, how do you have the president of the United States that doesn't appear to understand the basic structure of our government and our constitutional system?
He doesn't understand separation of powers. He doesn't understand checks and balances. He doesn't understand the concept of three co-equal branches of government.
Dr. Lynn, I don't think he understands Schoolhouse Rock. Let's start there.
Well, let's go to the DOJ report. Inspector General Michael Horowitz for the Department of Justice released his much-anticipated 500-page report, the most comprehensive look back at the investigation into Mrs. Clinton's use of an unclassified private email server. What was your take away from what you've read and also the analysis that you've heard about this report through mainstream media?
For me, Dr. Leon, it's kind of pretty much as expected. I think what the practical aspect of it is that it provides ammunition for people who want to spin the news and control the news cycle. I think ultimately, what the report says is bad things happened. They were not necessarily intentional or politically biased, and there was no net result on the outcome of the election other than arguably it undermined the Clinton campaign. How I deal with James Comey is this. Me being from Arkansas and a conservative Democrat, I found what he did was very unfortunate, and I thought that it was violating the DOJ policies on the eve of an election. Really did have a dramatic impact. But as a whistleblower, how he defended himself, in one sense, it's kind of honorable in the sense that James Comey may be the most important whistleblower since Daniel Ellsberg or Mark Phil, Deep Throat, and Watergate.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the, it's kind of a conundrum. As a matter of fact, I think we've invited him to come to the summit this year. We'll see if he shows. But what he did in terms of the release of these memos and how he basically preserved the record that ultimately wound up empowering Mueller may wind up making him the most significant whistleblower in the last 40 years.
Now, that's an analysis I was not expecting, but that's a very, very, I had not looked at it that way because I'm looking at Comey and looking at those under him, Ms. Page and Mr. Strzok and their email exchanges. And I'm saying, how could his underlings have been doing what they were doing and Comey have no clue?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, I haven't gone through all 500 pages.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is you're talking about people who essentially had loose lips on government devices.
Right.
From the time, Dr. Leon, I apologize. I may actually let one rip on the air. I hope I don't.
Well, we got a pause button. Okay. Dimitri's ready. He's got his finger on the button.
It doesn't necessarily go to that they use their institutional power to take advantage or to treat unfairly one of the other candidates. In one sense, they kind of, to me, that's more so locker room talk than the stuff that the president said on the bus.
Okay.
I didn't see that much from the underlings that was of any material consequence. Again, what I look at it is I imagine myself being in a situation where the president of the United States tells me to do something wrong. And what would I think? What would I do? And then more importantly, how would I do it? And when I look at James Comey from that perspective, I kind of admire the guy.
I just look at this email exchange and understand also that we don't have the full record of the exchanges, which is part of what I think the Senate committee is still trying to get from the Department of Justice. When you have Lisa Page saying to her counterpart, "Oh no, will Trump really become president?" and Strzok saying, "No, he won't. We'll stop it."
Dr. Leon, I said that. I sent that text. Email.
Yeah, but you're not in that position. It just strikes me as odd, and that could be the conspiracy theorist in me. I could be reading more into this than there is, but
it strikes me as human. And I think, and that's the point that I was trying to make.
Okay.
The question becomes, not did they say it, because clearly they said it.
Mm-hmm.
Human beings do say things, do say things like that.
And they may have said more. We don't have the whole record, so we don't know.
That's true.
Okay.
The question becomes, what is the evidence that they use their institutional power, their institutional prerogatives, to disadvantage then candidate Trump or Senator Clinton? And so I think Comey actually did more damage in terms of violating Justice Department regulations than the two underlings did. I mean, essentially that was just locker room talk. The evidence that said that they put something into works, other memos, other leaked information, you know, what have you. But based on the text messages alone, I don't give that much, you know, much credence. However, I'm sure that it's going to be played up heavily on Sean Hannity's show, and I'm sure it'll be retweeted a million times a day.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the president has already come out and said on one hand he thought that the report was relieved him of liability, but then he goes on to say he thought at the end that the report was terrible. So he can't exonerate. That's the word I was looking for. The president says on one hand that the report exonerates him, which it actually does not. And because it wasn't even there to address the issue that he claims he's exonerated for. And then at the end, he says, yeah, but the whole thing really missed the point.
I'm going to date myself, but my response to the thing about pages, again, where's the beef?
There you go. There's another interesting story that hasn't gotten a whole lot of legs yet. An American editorial cartoonist has been fired for skewing Trump. Pittsburgh Post-Gazette cartoonist Rob Rogers, editorial cartoonist for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette for more than 25 years, is fired. Most working cartoonists have had occasional ideas spiked by his or her editor, but in the past few weeks, Keith Burris and publisher John Robinson Block have refused to publish Rogers' cartoons, all of which were criticizing Trump or his policies. Looking at this through the lens of a whistleblower, how damaging do you think this could be, not only to Mr. Rogers, but going forward in terms of an independent press?
Well, beyond the conversation I just had talking about the benefits to pop culture that whistleblowing provides our society, whistleblowing is also really related to the First Amendment. You know, I tell people that, you know, that there's no free press without news sources. There's no congressional oversight without government informants.
Mm-hmm.
We really are the fifth estate that protect our freedom and liberty. And so not to harp on the summit, but one of the other things that we do at the summit is we recognize whistleblowers, but more so, we also recognize policymakers and journalists. And so I was very happy when I went. I was very intrigued when I saw that article. And as a matter of fact, we may be considering honoring him with some type of recognition at the summit
mm-hmm.
next month. So no, I think that satire is one of the most it's one of the most effective tools for organizing, for community organizing, because, I mean, that's one of the things that the establishment hates the most is to be ridiculed. And there's a lot of things that you can say in jest that ring true. So, again, I was appalled when I read the article, and I definitely want to do whatever I can to lift up that gentleman and bring attention to his work and to his plight.
You know what's interesting to me? I'm glad you brought up the word satire, because I have this here. This was the next point that I was going to raise. And when we understand the history of journalism in this country, we understand the power, particularly of political cartoons, there is a special place in journalism for that political cartoonist, and it has been that way for the history of this country. Especially when you started with understanding low literacy rates in this country, that when we were more of an agrarian economy and society, and people lived not in cities but in villages and on farms, and the literacy rate was incredibly low, one of the very effective ways that you could make a point to someone was through a picture. As they say, a picture is worth 1,000 words. And so then we fast forward to the Obama administration, and I know you remember all of those cartoons that were being sketched about President Obama, even his family. Many of them were caricatures of them as primates. It was a cover of a magazine with the Obamas looking like terrorists. And the pass that was given in many instances was, this is just satire. This is just political satire.
Definitely, don't stop there. During that same time, if you remember the cartoons with the that upset a lot of the Muslim brothers and sisters when they were I can't remember the outlet, but just the act of depicting Allah.
That was in France. You're talking about the cartoons in the cartoonist in France.
So just
Charlie Hebdo.
Absolutely, that's it. That's correct. Yeah, so really the power of the imagery, the unique role that it plays, in, especially in our society. When I read that, man, I was flabbergasted, but I wasn't surprised.
But what is really shocking to me is that this story, I didn't hear Rachel Maddow talking about it. I haven't heard it on CNN. I have not. This to me should be front and center about an attack on journalists and the attack on the First Amendment in this country.
Dr. Lamb, personally, I hear about all kinds of stories that I don't see carried on.
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, you're right about that.
So,
that's why people listen to Radio Sputnik.
There you go. It's a place for independent journalists. You know, and then now they're citizens journalists. So you know, that doesn't surprise me at all. I would hope that we can raise awareness to it through these alternative media sources that will eventually be picked up by mainstream. Because I don't see why a CNN or a MSNBC would not pick that story up, not at least not off the top of my head. It may have to deal with some type of corporate ownership. But.
Michael McCray, tell people how they can get more information about the Whistleblower Summit for Civil and Human Rights.
Whistleblower Summit for Civil and Human Rights can be found at www.whistleblowersummit.com, whistleblowersummit.com. And you can find out more information about me, www.michaelmccray, Michael McCray, .net.
Whistleblowersummit.com. And this, the upcoming summit is next month. When and where?
It is various locales on Capitol Hill. If you go to the website, you'll see the different venues. But the summit next month is July 30th and 31st.
And people can also go to your website and get your books, Race, Power, and Politics, Memoirs of an Acorn Whistleblower, as well as Truth, Transparency, and Accountability Inside the Fall of Acorn. Michael McCray, thank you very much. Have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you, Dr. Leon.
You got it. You've been listening to The Critical Hour here, Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all next week right here, Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. Have a wonderful weekend. I'm out.